Hello and welcome to Is This Thing On, the podcast hosted by me, Sachin Nakrani, and a woman who shot the deputy, Lindsay Bowers. How are you?
But I didn't shoot the sheriff.
You did not shoot the sheriff. We know you shot the sheriff. He admitted to it on record.
Who?
Big Bad Bob.
Who's that?
Bob Marley.
Oh. Oh, fail.
Did you not know what that song was reference was?
No, I didn't actually.
But then how did you know about the sheriff bit?
Well, I know the song.
Right. Oh, did you not know it was by Bob Marley?
I guess thinking about it, it's quite obvious because it is very much in his style. Yeah. So, yeah.
There you go.
Sorry. I'm still waking up a little bit, to be honest, Sachin.
Are you a bit tired?
You keep on booking these recording sessions for Mondays and, you know.
Yeah. So, should we set the scene? It's Monday evening. We're in the Duke. It's a bit more busy than it was the last time recorded here on the Monday, which is
weird. We're here a little bit later, aren't
we? Yeah, with lovely Bella Hull. But yeah, this time we're slightly later.
Lovely
Bella Hull. The amazing, very funny Bella Hull. Thanks again to her for coming on, if she's listening. Yeah, a bit more busy. It is pitch black outside because we are recording on the first full day after the clocks went back. So it's very dark, very wintry. I think I said this on the last podcast. I'm a bit of a winter person. I quite like this evening vibe when it's dark and a bit cold.
You don't
you're more of a summer person.
I'm bloody miserable.
I quite like it. And the one really good thing I like about the winter is getting a central line to this pub. So for people who don't live in London, probably have a sense of the underground system, you may well have used it as well. The underground line I need to use to get from work at King's Cross to the Duke is the central line. Well, I use two lines. I use a metropolitan line and a central line. And the central line is horrible for me.
I thought you said you liked the central
line. No, I hate it. I hate it. It's the sweatiest, grubbiest, most horrible underground line there is. Never any air conditioning. Always seems to be packed, whatever time of day. And in the first few podcasts we've done here, I've come here all a bit sweaty and a bit sticky because we've been recording generally during the summer, the warm weeks. I got the central line here today and it was still a bit sort of muggy and a bit sort of grimy, but it was actually a lot cooler, a lot more pleasant.
I've got a story about the central line from this weekend actually.
Is this the one you told me before we started recording? It's a cracker.
It's
go
a
ahead
bit random, but I went out on Saturday night and it was quite a late one. And usually when I stay out late in central London, I'm very lazy and just, you know, open up Uber, try and get an Uber home. But because it was awful weather, they did the fare surge thing. So if I was going to get one home, it was going to cost me 60, 70 quid. So I thought,
Where was this from?
Soho, sort of area.
Okay.
I thought, sod that. I'm actually, you know, it's not going to take me that long to get home, but the tube's running at night. I might as well take advantage of it. So I decided to get the tube home at about 2:30 in the morning. And this was actually quite a cool experience because everyone's a little bit tipsy. And, I had to wait 40 minutes for a tube from, Leicester Square? Tottenham Court Road. I was in the central line. Apart from the fact that I had to wait for ages for a tube, everyone was like really friendly and I was just like talking to people around me and making friends. And then by the time I got off here in Wanstead, one of the chaps I was talking to got off a tube with me. And then as we were walking out, suddenly he was like, oh, do you want a bit of this? And he's putting his key under my nose and it had some white powder on it. And I was like, what's that?
I wonder what that could be.
I was so naive. I actually went to him, what's that? And he went, Coke, do you want some? I was like, no, thank you.
Bloody
and I was hell. Like, okay, anyway, have a nice rest of your night. Bye.
Wow.
But I was like, imagine, like, I don't think I would have got to sleep ever, would I? 2:30 in the morning, but I don't know much
about
that.
I've never taken cocaine. I have been offered it.
Well, that's the thing. It works in the media. People think you get offered it all the time, but I have been offered it before, but that's the first time in a very long time.
And the first time at 2:30 on the underground as well.
By a complete stranger. Yeah.
I mean, I've still yet to use the underground. Obviously, now it's 24 hours, or most lines are. Is it just specific the weekend they're 24 hours? Or
I'm not sure, to be honest, but I'm very glad it was running at that particular time. Otherwise, I'd be very out of pocket.
Yeah, but I have got many night buses at that time, and it's always just full of mad, crazy people doing mad, crazy things.
No. I'm really snobby about buses. I'm scared of them because I never, ever, ever know where to get off or where to get on for that matter. I'm just absolutely useless.
Is this during the day as well?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
No, I use buses all the time. Absolutely fine. I sort of find them easier in a way because you can look out the window and you can sort of, you can say, oh, I live around there, or that's near the place I'm going, I'll just get off here. Whereas the underground, you're in darkness.
I feel like I like to zone out and not think about where I'm going, and on the tube I can do that. Although, saying that, on my way home from work today, I did miss my stop, which I do quite often because I had my head in my phone.
Lindsay, what are you looking at your phone? You're not getting a signal down there. So why are you on your
phone? Oh, no, on the Central Line, from Stratford, outside. Yeah.
Stratford, Leighton Stone.
I was looking at my social medias.
Wanstead.
And sometimes when I'm reading my Kindle or book, I just get so immersed. I look up and I'm in South Woodford, which is a stop past Snaresbrook. And
And that's the end of the geeky Central Line chat.
Anyway, train spotting.
Very good. So we're on the red wine as well tonight because I am not in the mood for lager. I went to Liverpool yesterday to watch my football team play Tottenham Hotspur. They won. Very good day. A couple of pints in the pub beforehand, a couple of cans on the coach on the way back. Feeling a bit fuzzy this morning. Couldn't face lager. So I'm on the red wine. And as anyone who listens to this podcast knows, I like red wine, so I'm not complaining. I do like red wine. So we've already stacked up a couple of glasses. You finished
yours. Yeah, can I just say, I came in, Sachin texts me on my way here saying, red wine? And I said, yep. I got in, and there are two of the tiddliest, tiniest little glasses of red wine I've ever seen in my life. And I looked at him and said, well, we're definitely going to have to get another one before we even start, because there's no way that's going to last the whole of part one. So I've already gone and got a medium instead of a small, and...
Yeah, I was being a massive cheapskate. I got two smalls. Yours is finished. Mine is halfway through. And then we're going to get into our second... Well, you'll get into your second one very soon. And I'll get into mine shortly after. But yeah, couldn't face lager today. But yeah, back at the Duke. Always happy to be here. Lovely and wintry. I think they'll probably have their Christmas decorations out before we know it as well. So
there's lots of bunting up in here, actually, isn't there? Which is more of a summer thing.
It does look like a queen has been coronated over the weekend without us realising or something. But yeah, another podcast. It's just us two, no guests today. Got a lot of interesting things to discuss as well, I think. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk midlife crisis. That's going to be our deep dive conversation later on. Both got a lot to say. We were talking before we started recording. I don't think either of us realised how much the other person had to say on this topic. So
we depressed each other thoroughly, to be honest. Yeah, but we'll promise we'll try not to depress you too much.
Yeah, it's going to be a bit deep and a bit heavy, but hopefully
interesting. No, let's try and be funny. Let's try and keep some of it like.
We'll try and laugh through it. Got to laugh through your pain. Laugh through the pain of getting old. Then we'll obviously have the quiz, which Lindsay is helming today. I'm very excited to discover what she's got in store. But before we do that, we're going to talk meeting famous people. And the reason for this is two things that happened to me in quite a short space of time. So I'll say the second one first. I read a really interesting article by an American writer called... Let me get his name right. I've got the article here. It's got quite a tricky surname, shall I say.
I can see it from here. Should I give it a go?
Yeah, go on. You give it a go.
I would pronounce that as Dan Peepenbring.
Dan Peepenbring, yeah. I think that's the correct pronunciation. So this is an article he actually wrote in September, and I had bookmarked on Twitter, on my likes, for absolute ages. And I finally got around to reading on Thursday, Friday. And it's for The New Yorker. And the title of the piece is called The Book of Prince. And it's a really interesting article. It's a bit of a long read, but I do recommend it to anyone. You'll probably find it quite easy on Google. So just to give the brief summary of the story, Dan Peepenbring is an American writer. He's also a huge fan of Prince. And before Prince died, he decided he wanted to write his memoirs. And he obviously wanted a ghostwriter to do this for him. And the way he went about this is he didn't want to get an established writer. He wanted to get one of his fans to do the book. So he kind of scouted out bloggers, you know, Prince bloggers, and people who'd written to him, and auditioned them to write his memoirs. And the winner, if you want to put it like that, was Dan Peepenbring. So Prince invited him to Paisley Park, which is his, you know, enormous kind of recording living complex in Minnesota. Yeah, that's right, where Prince is from. So he still lived in his hometown. And the article is Dan saying what happened to him with Prince. So he met his idol, got to know him quite well. They discussed in his book over quite a long period of time. Prince even flew him out to Australia while he was on tour there to discuss it. And it was going to happen. I think I'm right in saying they had a contract as well with a publisher, and then obviously Prince died in the spring of 2016, so it never happened. Now, reading the article, I think it may never have happened, and I think Dan Peepenbring would probably be happy for that to be put out there, because as you read it, you see that Prince puts this off a lot. He never really gets around to sort of sitting down and doing it properly and discussing it properly. And I think my theory is, more than anything, he just wanted company.
Yeah,
and he wanted someone to talk to, and maybe sense that he was coming to the final stage of his life, and just wanted someone to share his thoughts with, and he gets very deep in a way that only Prince can. So that was interesting. Anyway, so that happened, and the other thing that happened just before that, I've got to be careful how I say this. I didn't meet one of my childhood heroes. I'd known him for quite a long time. We'd done a few things together, but I did a work project with him. That's all I'm going to say, and it didn't go well. And it totally lived up to the cliche of never meet your heroes. It was a really ugly, horrible experience. It sort of lived with me for a few days afterwards. And even now, I'm only sort of slightly getting over it. And it really did hurt me. It really did affect me. He was kind of unhappy with what I'd done. Became very abusive and sweary and just quite obnoxious and arrogant about the whole thing. And what the experience sort of showed me, and I've had this with other people as well, is obviously my job, I deal with a lot of famous people in terms of sports people, you know, footballers specifically. Yeah. I'll be intrigued to hear your thoughts. You obviously deal with a lot of famous people, and not all famous people, but I think some of the ones I've dealt with, even those who are genuinely grounded or certainly think they're grounded, they just are out of touch with reality sometimes. I think they do things which us mere mortals wouldn't dream of. For instance, I just wouldn't dream of treating another human being the way this person treated me, and I think he did it because of who he was, because of the status he has. And if I can give you one small other example before I let you in, Lindsay, is somebody else very famous, very well known, another former footballer I dealt with a few years back, and he's a really nice guy actually, and didn't do anything wrong, but I ghosted a column that he did for The Guardian during one period, and it was fine generally, but it was this one week where I said to him, look, we've got to speak on this Friday, and I've got, because of deadline, we have to speak on this Friday for me to get your column done so I can file it to my editor and it can go in the paper. And he said, yeah, that's fine. Called him up on Friday, couldn't get through to him. I was getting really panicky because I was like, I have to speak to him soon to get this, obviously, speak to him, written up and sent over to the editor. I finally made contact with him about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I said, where have you been? You know, we meant to speak today. And he said, oh, I went fancy going skiing, so me and my wife went skiing. So he was in Austria or something, or Switzerland, I can't remember. And I just thought,
how the other half
lived? Well, A, how the other half lived, but B, did you not think to text me to say you might be on the slopes at this time and that we, you know, that this thing that we had nailed down that we were going to do might be affected by it? And it was just an example again of, and I said, he's a good guy, I have no issues with him as a person, and you know, we got the column done and it was fine. But again, that sense of disconnect with reality, that you don't think that you should tell somebody you've arranged to speak to for something that's quite important, that for a chunk of time on the day that you've decided that you've organized to meet or speak, I should say, you're not going to be around because you're skiing. It's just one of those mad things that I think only famous people do. So the Prince article, the situation I had recently with this other person, my memories about the guy who went skiing, they all just kind of came together for me to think it'd be quite an interesting sort of discussion for us to have, because obviously in your line of work you deal with a lot of well-known people as well.
When I worked at ITV in particular, I met a lot of really well-known people. I'm trying to think, you know, with the whole, you know, meeting your heroes thing, I have met one of my heroes, and I was led to believe it would be a disappointment, and it turned out to be anything but.
Oh, great.
The hero is Andrew Lloyd Webber. I grew up absolutely obsessed with many of his musicals, loved a lot of his songs since I was very, very small. And he came in, he was on the show I was working on, and I went up to his PA or whoever was with him and said, oh, I'm huge, I don't usually do this, but I'm an absolutely mega fan of Sir Lloyd Webber. Is he Sir? I think he is a Sir.
I think so. Is he a Lord?
Or Lord? Lord?
Lord Andrew Webber.
But I can't remember what I said. Whatever I said was probably wrong. And she was very sort of, we can try and approach him, but he's not in a very good mood today, basically. It's something to the effect of, you can try, but he will, you know, not be very accommodating. And I kind of timed it so that I kind of... I can't remember what I did. I was a little bit sneaky about it. I think he was talking to Piers Morgan, the presenter of the show, and I kind of went up and like said something to Piers and then sort of turned to Andrew and went, "Oh, casually." And I said, "Oh, I absolutely adore your work. Would you mind awfully if we could have a picture together?" And he was absolutely nice as pie.
Oh, really?
Lovely, lovely man. Had a picture with him. And afterwards, the woman he was with turned around to me and went, "Oh, well, he must have liked you." So that was a moment I cherished. Like, I was absolutely, over the moon about that. Anyway, celebrities I've met who have been let down. I think the only one I can kind of... In my experience... Aging supermodels are more likely to be difficult.
Oh, it's quite a specific group of people.
Only because I can think of two in particular who, well, one in particular came in and everyone thought she was an absolute nightmare. She was just really demanding and really rude. And another one, she wasn't particularly rude or nasty, but she was just very, very, like, a lot of my job was taking pictures of people for social media, and she wanted to see every single picture and retake them and different angles and different lightings. But I guess when your job is your face or your body, then
is that a clue?
21, but no, let's not give it away too much. No, but she was actually the one who was okay, but I'm not going to give any clues about the other one who everyone agreed was a bit difficult. But I don't think I've ever met anyone who I was excited about meeting and then they turned out to be a letdown. Usually I'm pleasantly surprised by how nice people are. I think you say, you know, celebrities can act like, you know, not like normal people and not in reality, but actually I really like being surprised by how down to earth some of them are.
No, I do in general have a lot of sympathy with famous people because I think most of them, 90%, 95%, are just normal people who have been thrust into this incredible life. And there's this pressure on them whenever they meet members of the public to live up to expectation or not to be arseholes. And sometimes you just get them on a bad day. And I have total sympathy. And this is why generally, if I see a famous person, I just, you know, it's quite rare if I see them out at work, you know, in a non-work context, I absolutely don't bother them or go up to them because I think they're just going about their day. They don't need someone sort of harassing them or crowding them. So I have total sympathy with that. I think the issue I had with the person whose name I won't mention is we had worked before. He knew me to a reasonable level. He'd been fine previously.
Is this the skiing one or the legend one?
The legend one, yeah. No, the skiing one was generally fine. It was just annoying that he was skiing, but he was actually okay.
You told me about the one who was your hero, but I don't know who the other one is. You'll have to tell me afterwards.
I will tell you afterwards, yeah. So, yeah, the one I met, yeah, because he's a hero, or was a hero. Still is to an extent, I guess. But so we'd worked before, and this was the horribleness of the horrible experience I had with him. It wasn't just like a snap moment. It was over a period basically of 2 days, an entire weekend of just horribleness. I won't get into too much detail. It was really unpleasant, and it really affected me. And so over that amount of time, you can then make a judgment on someone and say, you know what, I think, not that you're a horrible person, but you've got the capacity to be really horrible, and it's really affected me. And what it's made me think now is I don't want to meet anyone else who I consider a hero. One person specifically, because I think it would break my heart if they turned out to be an arsehole or didn't like me, is Noel Gallagher.
Yes.
Because I'm a huge Oasis fan.
You said that to me before.
Yeah, and I never want to meet Noel. I think most Oasis fans probably do want to meet Noel. I never want to meet Noel because if that went badly, it would break my heart. Because I listen to Oasis... Probably listen to an Oasis track at least once a day because I listen to a lot of music when I'm sort of travelling between work and home and other places. And if me and Noel didn't get on, or I didn't like him, or he didn't like me, it'd be horrible. So
I'm trying to never want to meet Noel.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, is there someone you think I never want to meet them because it would be so crushing?
When I was a teenager, I was obsessed with Madonna. But I've heard from many accounts that she is very difficult, and I think she has every right to be because she's an absolute legend. But although saying that, I don't like her anymore. I had to unfollow her on Instagram because I find her a bit tragic now. But yeah.
So a question to do a Dan Pippering: if you could write the memoirs of any famous person, if you could sit down and talk to someone about their life over a long period of time and turn that into a book or maybe a podcast, is there anyone in mind?
Well, I've been thinking about this. I was trying to go down the road of someone I really admire, and it was like people like Madonna, and it's been done to death. Like they've already had their memoirs written, and the whole not wanting to meet your heroes thing. So I kind of thought, who do I just find really interesting, or who would I just really, really love to hang out with? So I've got two. I've got a frivolous one and a kind of more serious one. The frivolous one is I would love to follow around and get to know and write about Cara Delevingne.
Okay.
Do you know who that is?
Singer? Pop star? Name rings a bell.
She's a supermodel actress. She's one of the most famous models in the world. She's British. I just absolutely kind of love her, really. She's a posh girl. She is a Victoria's Secret model, but also very androgynous and quite boyish. And if you follow her on Twitter and Instagram, one thing that becomes very apparent very soon upon following her is she's very, very, very down to earth and isn't afraid to take the piss out of herself. Pulls like ugly faces and stuff in her videos and is very relaxed. Often seen going out and getting wasted, like in the DM, the Daily Mail website all the time, like off her face. But she's really, she kind of speaks out about a lot of good causes. Like she's in a relationship with a woman and she's gone public with it. She says, I'm in love with this woman, and she's been very open about her sexuality, which I think is great. She's dating an actress called Ashley Benson. She's been open about her mental health, admitted she's had depression, which I think is really good because she's got so many young fans. She's just funny and warm, and I would love to just follow her around for a few months. In terms of just a person in general who really, really, really intrigues me, and I would love to know what is in their brain, Amanda Knox.
Blimey, I didn't see that coming.
Yeah.
Wow.
I am so intrigued by her, mostly because I do not believe her side of the story.
Fascinating.
I think she is a liar. I think she's a narcissist. Yeah. I think she's a sociopath. And I'm absolutely intrigued by her. I don't think she... I mean, do I have to explain who she is? Surely everyone's listening to this will know.
I was trying to think, as you were speaking, I was thinking, how long ago was that? I think that was well over 10 years, wasn't it?
Just for very, very quick recap.
Yeah, go through it again.
Amanda Knox is an American woman. I reckon she's probably about 32 years of age now, somewhere about that ballpark. She went to university in Italy, and she was roommates with a British girl called Meredith Kircher, who was found brutally murdered in the apartment. And Amanda ended up going to prison for a couple of years, I think it was, in Perugia.
Something like that, yeah.
Her and her boyfriend at the time were sent down for it. And another man, where they literally found evidence that he had done it, slit her throat. But there's so many twists and turns in the story. I mean, the Italian justice system completely let just the Kirchers down completely, and possibly even Knox herself, because they just didn't carry out the investigation well enough at all. It's a really fascinating case, but it's fascinating because she just changed her story so much. She behaved bizarrely, absolutely bizarrely around it. I mean, the day after the murder happened, press got pictures of her doing cartwheels like outside the apartment and snogging the face of her boyfriend and going out to buy a thong. It was proven she'd lied and changed her story, but then was that because the Italian system made her do that? I don't know, but there's just something about her that I feel like, I don't think she held the knife herself and did it, but I feel like she was part of it, that she was there, that she knew something, and I'm intrigued by her.
Well, that's fascinating, Amanda Knox. I haven't got one to match that, really. I was trying to think about this on the way here.
I've gone on for ages, so who do you want to write a memoir about?
No, it's fascinating. Well, two choices, like you, I've got two. One's sort of frivolous, one quite deep. But the frivolous one is, not frivolous, but as you probably could tell from the last podcast we did, I love talking to stand-up comedians. I'm slightly obsessed with stand-up comedy as a form of entertainment and the processes and techniques involved. I'm fascinated by it. So someone like Dave Chappelle, the American stand-up comedian, who I think is in the top three best stand-ups working in the world at the moment, and one of the maybe top 20 of all time, I could imagine sitting over a bottle of red wine with him and talking to him. And so any excuse to spend time with stand-up comedians, so that would be one. The other deeper one would be, and he's not a celebrity in any way, is my dad, who I really don't know very well at all. We're both awful at talking, at communicating with each other, which I know sounds mad for someone who's sat in a pub doing a podcast, but me and my dad just never have particularly good conversations. We never have. It's always very fleeting. And about 4 years ago, 4 years ago exactly, I think, or 5 years ago, I guess it would be now, I actually wrote a book about supporting Liverpool I wrote it with a friend of mine, and we had loads of contributors who were Liverpool fans. And as part of the book, I explored why I was a Liverpool fan. And the reason I'm a Liverpool fan is because my dad is a Liverpool fan. And I realised I'd never really spoken to him about how he came about supporting Liverpool. So I actually called him up. I remember one Friday on the way home from the pub after work, and I just asked him a simple question: why do you support Liverpool? And it was probably the most deepest, longest, most interesting conversation we ever had. And I remember coming away from that thinking, I should talk to my dad more.
That's
and he
amazing.
Has lived, first generation immigrant, brought up a family in this country, done various jobs, now well into his 60s. And I think, I don't know anything about this man. And he's lived a fascinating, interesting life. And maybe before he's no longer with us, I should probably sit down and talk to him more and learn more about his life and things
think
he likes, like
random,
what's he into.
But simple questions like that, because that's such a simple question, and it opened a floodgate, I imagine. And that's great.
Yeah, it was really interesting. But like, I know nothing. What was his dreams as a kid? You know, does he like music? What's the best film he's ever seen? You know, what's the funniest TV show he's ever watched? I just really don't know.
Yeah.
And it's maybe a man thing. It's certainly a me and my dad thing. We don't talk a lot more. So if I was going to sit down with anyone and just have a long chat with them, maybe put on record what they said and try and put their life into a piece of kind of written work, probably my dad.
Does your dad listen to this?
No. I don't think he even knows who I work for. I remember a few years ago just saying to him, Dad, who do I work for? And he said, The Times. And I worked for The Guardian for the last 12 years. So he takes only a semi-interest in my life.
To be fair, Times is pretty cool.
Anyway, well, that's quite deep. And we're going to talk about more deep stuff after a little break. I think I might go for a quick wee.
I need a wee as well. And more wine.
A wee and more wine. Less urine, more wine. And then... no need for that, was there? And then we will talk about something very deep, which is... midlife crisis. I'm back from the bar. Got Lindsay a glass of red wine, a third glass of red wine. I'm sticking to two because I really am quite fuzzy after my day on the lager yesterday at the football. So
he's got a bloody coffee.
Yeah, I was going to say, Lindsay's going to now take the piss out of me because I have a coffee, a cappuccino from the bar.
Today, I was thinking, I'm tired, it's Monday, I really don't want to drink tonight, so I'm only going to have, you know, a tiny bit of wine. But, you know, if we're doing this podcast, we're doing this podcast.
Yeah, I've got to get fully involved. No, usually I would be all up for it, but, what is this? So set two glasses of red wine. My second glass of red wine.
You've had one and a half glasses.
One and a half. I will get through this second one.
I've had two in a bit.
And a lovely cappuccino. I do like coffee, so I'm quite excited.
I like a cappuccino, actually.
I'm looking at it. I'm observing it. It looks gorgeous. Can't wait to get into it.
I'm looking at it with disdain.
Fully entitled to.
If an Italian saw you drinking cappuccino at, what's the time?
8 o'clock.
8 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
I don't think they'd be very impressed.
Yeah.
Less impressed than I am.
Can I say that reminds me of a really funny Michael McIntyre joke talking about stand-up comedians that he told one of his live shows that was on telly once about just that very thing. He said, isn't it mad how we go to restaurants, you go to a restaurant with your partner or your friend or something, and it could be 10 o'clock at night and the waiter comes around and goes, does anyone want coffee? And you go, yeah, I'll have a cappuccino.
Yeah, no, I do that as well, actually.
If you're at home and your partner said at 10 o'clock at night, do you want a cappuccino? You look at them and go, are you fucking mad?
Yeah.
At restaurants, we just happily have cappuccinos at 10 o'clock
Whereas
at night.
If I go out for a meal with my mum, it will be Irish coffee. I would never ever have an Irish coffee. But with my mum, no, why don't we have coffee with 8 shots of alcohol in it?
Yeah. So I'm having a cappuccino at 8 o'clock. But I think that's okay because... not planning to go to bed for about 3 hours, and I've got tomorrow off as well, so if I don't get a lot of sleep.
Oh, have you?
Well, oh. I will be working, Lindsay. I'll be editing this podcast.
No excuse for that cappuccino, yeah. Then.
I'll be editing.
Are you editing tomorrow?
I will be editing tomorrow,
make sure,
yeah.
You edit all the things out that I just told you to edit out.
Yeah, Lindsay wants a few things knocked out, which you won't hear by the very nature of the fact that I'll be editing them out. So
yeah, I think I might have libeled Amanda Knoxer.
Yeah. Possibly. Right, should we move on to our other conversation then? So this is quite deep and heavy, but I think really interesting as well. Midlife crisis. Crises, if that's the word.
Are you going through one?
Yeah, I genuinely think I am. So the way this came about, it was something I wanted to discuss for a while anyway, because I do think it's a very real interesting topic, but specifically it came about because back in May, I read an article by Zoe Williams, who's a columnist for The Guardian, about this very topic, and she in this article explained how she was going through her own midlife crisis in her early 40s, and it's a really interesting, fascinating article where she talks to academics and behavioral experts and people in general about the idea of a midlife crisis. And it really struck me because it's probably the first time in my life I read something about this topic that wasn't taking the piss at the idea of a midlife crisis. Yeah. Because I think growing up, I think we're all guilty of this. We look at midlife crisis as a very humorous, funny thing. I think we've been fed stereotypes, the classic one being, you know, the guy in his 50s who suddenly decides to buy a Lamborghini or a Ferrari or Harley Davidson, you know, leaves his wife for the secretary at work. Or maybe the more iconic figure or the personification of a midlife crisis is Reginald Perrin, the sitcom character from the 70s, who I remember when it was repeated on the BBC in the late 80s or early 90s, you know, watching him for the first time then, and this guy who completely lost his way in life and went a bit mad and tried to disappear, and I think, if I remember right, faked his own death because he essentially went through a midlife crisis. So I think the examples we have of midlife crisis in our life are very extreme and quite comical and can be quite frivolous, but I think it's a genuine thing, and I think at the age of 38, I'm definitely experiencing it. And just to go through some basic stuff, so I was intrigued before coming out to meet Lindsay today to find out the dictionary definition of a midlife crisis. And I found one on the Cambridge Online Dictionary. So it is a feeling of unhappiness, worry and disappointment that some people experience at about 40 years old that can lead to them making important changes in their life. According to the article Zoe Williams wrote as well, it was coined first by the idea, the phrase midlife crisis, by a Canadian psychoanalyst called Elliot Jacques in 1965. He was the first person apparently who ever used the phrase midlife crisis. And according to Zoe Williams in the piece, the first time she started thinking about it deeply was she interviewed a pianist called James Rhodes, and during their interview he used the phrase, "Am I happy? No, not really, but I've got a mortgage." And that made Zoe Williams sort of think about life and think, we achieve these things in our sort of late 30s, early 40s, but do they actually make us happy? And it really made me think as well, to think, I've got a mortgage, but am I happy? And I think I am happy, but I definitely am not as happy as I think I should be, or certainly wish I was. And I feel myself, as I said, at 38 years old, reflecting an awful lot on my youth and the sense that it's completely got away from me. And I'm at a stage in my life where I'm much older than I feel I am. Or I'm at a stage in life where,
yeah,
I'm being defined by certain parameters which I'd rather not be. And I should absolutely stress at this time that, because this is quite a difficult, awkward conversation, that, you know, I feel incredibly grateful and lucky for the life I have. I'm married to an amazing, beautiful woman. I've got an amazing...
And does she know you feel like this?
I think so, yeah.
And does she take it personally at all?
Hope not. No, I don't think so. And we have, you know, we went through quite a difficult time a couple of years ago where this was all sort of... When I first really sort of came to grips that I was going through this, and we sort of talked through it, and things are a lot better now.
Yeah.
But yeah, look, I'm incredibly... I've got an amazing family. My daughter's just the most amazing human being I've met. I do have a mortgage, but that's a good thing, because that means I've got a house.
Yeah.
I've got a job that I love. I've got a good group of friends. We're doing this podcast, which is really exciting and fun. So I don't want to sound ungrateful. I've got a lot of good things going on in my life, and I wake up every morning very appreciative of what I've got. But that doesn't sort of take away from the feeling that, as I said, I'm in my late 30s, and just this sense that life has kind of got away from me. And I'm at a stage in my life where I don't feel utterly comfortable with my circumstance. And so one way to put it is, I think when you're in your 20s, being in your 20s for me is like being, it's like Christmas Eve. It's really exciting, and there's this sense of anticipation of what you're going to achieve. You know, what job you're going to have, where you're going to live, what you're going to experience, who you're going to, you know, the various people you're going to meet and spend time with, whether that's friends or partners. And then
shag,
basically. And then you get into your 30s, and your 30s is like Christmas Day. You arrive at that point, and you've got everything that you were excited about in your 20s. And that's great, and there's a sense of achievement and satisfaction, but also all the excitement, anticipation has gone, and that leaves you feeling quite flat, as we often do on Christmas Day. Christmas Day can be quite a flat, boring day. I don't know what it's like at your house, Lindsay, but mine can be quite dull.
So are you in that horrible period of time between Boxing Day and New Year's Eve of your life?
Well, I'm in Christmas Day, I think, where everything is really nice. Yeah, everything is really nice. It's lovely. It's great. And as I said, I do appreciate it. And it's warm and fuzzy and lovely. And I'm very lucky and I'm very grateful for what I've got in my life. But everything's just a bit flat. And I miss the buzz and the excitement of Christmas Eve. I miss the anticipation of
what's to come.
Exactly. That excitement we have. And, you know, I do just think the 20s are... For me, and everyone will be different, but for me, are the best decade of your life. And if I can say one thing to any 20-year-olds who are listening to this, is grasp every opportunity you get, take every risk you can get, because when you're in that period of your life, honestly, trust me when I say this as a 38-year-old man who's very close to turning 39, there'll come a point to your life where those things leave you, those opportunities leave you, you settle down, everything's a lot calmer and a lot quieter in life, and it's quite hard to sort of contemplate that basically... This is going to sound really grim. There's nothing really left except a slow march to death, really. You're just kind of repeating the same day every day, and it's fine and it's fun and it's, well, not fun. Well, it can be fun, but it can be very rewarding. But yeah, sorry, I know I'm sounding really grim and slightly depressed about it all, but that's why it's called a crisis, I think.
Okay, I'm going to have to come in here.
You're going to have to come in here.
I'm chomping at a bit here. Okay. So we had a little chat about this before we started recording, and I was kind of in agreement with you. As someone who's just turned 35, getting older is hard. And as someone who's, you know, got engaged and just got a mortgage, well, actually, I'm in the period of life where everything's new and exciting and about to happen. But hearing that from you is a little bit scary, thinking, you know, there is this kind of element of, you know, I'm settling down, is that it? But I think life in general is an ebb and flow. And I said to you before we started recording, youth is wasted on the young.
I totally agree with that.
Because when you're young and you have this incredible, incredible power called youth, you don't realise the power that you have. You don't appreciate it at the time. And we are not old. When we're in our 40s, 50s, 60s, we'll look at us now and be like, why the hell were you worried? Why weren't you enjoying what you had then? Yeah. I mean, your daughter's 8 years old, yeah?
Yeah.
One day she's going to be a teenager and you'll be looking back to now thinking, I should have appreciated that time more. You said to me before we started recording, you don't feel any different health-wise, you don't have any aches or pains.
No.
Enjoy being mobile, enjoy going to your football matches, enjoy being sound of mind, you know? God, I'm like suddenly being really optimistic after feeling really...
I was
really
going to say, when we were talking before and you were as down about life as I was.
Yeah, but do you know what? I'm not having a midlife crisis, but I'm having a little crisis, but it's very superficial. It's very superficial. It's very vain and... looks orientated. So as we know, I turned 35 recently, and I'm very, very aware of looking older and feeling a bit older. And in my brain, I'm 28. I have been for a long time now, like, sort of, you know, still quite young of mind. But I'm starting to see the signs of aging, and I feel like a massive hypocrite because I've blogged about sexual harassment and men who will, like, kind of touch me up or try and chat to me on the tube or, you know, just all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, at the back of my head, I'm going to admit this, I am very aware that the clock is ticking and I've only got a few years left of men even noticing me. The biggest fear for women who are worried about aging is becoming invisible.
Okay, that's interesting.
And it's not just about wanting to attract dick, you know. It's about just people noticing you and not even noticing you, just being there. And at the moment, I'm 35, but I still, you know, get attention when I go out. Men will always offer me their seat, and I assume it's not because they don't think I'm pregnant or in my 60s.
I can say, having known you for quite a while, I've never not once thought you were either pregnant or in your 60s.
I drink too much to be pregnant.
Yeah, if you were pregnant, it'd be incredibly worrying.
But I do think, I don't know, I just feel like my youth is in an egg timer, and the sand is going. And I can see it. It's really weird. I said to you before we started recording, I feel like I've aged a couple of years in the last couple of months, because it's like turning 35 has just made me so much more aware of everything.
I think that's really fascinating what you said there about, for women, it's about becoming invisible. Because, I mean, I said you've met the man that you want to spend the rest of your life with, the man you love, and you're going to get married next year. But also, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm going to try and put words in your mouth, you still want to be noticed by men.
It's not just men, it's just in general. I do feel like a lot of women feel like once they reach a certain age, they just become invisible to society. It's not about being sexually desired. It's just about being noticed, because women notice other women. I notice young women a lot because I envy them.
Is that also linked, sorry to say, specifically to the workplace? Because we hear, especially in the media, obviously once you become a woman of a certain age.
Not in the workplace, no. Do you know, weirdly, in the workplace, I feel more sort of, sorry, a man just walked past and said, don't fuck it up. But I thought he was saying it to us, but he was saying it to someone else.
Motto of this podcast as well. Don't fuck it up.
Tagline, don't fuck up. No, weirdly, in the workplace is where I feel more secure and content in myself. But I'm just talking about just going about your everyday life.
I think the physical aspect is really key as well. I mean, I was saying to you before we start recording as well that, you know, I catch my reflection in, you know, train windows, or you know, I'm waiting for the tube to come here or whatever, and or just, you know, in the mirror generally. And just sometimes it shocks me that, oh, that's how I look now. Because as you were saying, as I said to you, physically,
you're quite youthful looking though.
Yeah, I am generally, and it's weird. I feel
and
like
people tell me I look young for
because
my age a lot.
But I think we, you know, neither of us, I think, look old. That's the weird thing about it. I don't feel old either, but I am. And I think that's
you're
where
not.
The crisis element. Well,
neither of us are old.
Relatively so. But I think that's where the crisis element comes, and it's not that. As I said, it's not that I've got a horrible life, and I really want to stress this. I'm so appreciative of everything I've got in my life. But I think it's marrying up where you are in your life and how you feel about life. And I think there's a lot of people, loads of people, maybe the majority of people, who are in their late 30s, early 40s, 50s, whatever, and feel really comfortable with where they are, and that's great. But there are obviously people who are like, who do think, God, I'm 30 odd, but I don't feel any different to when I was 20 odd, and where have the last 10 years gone? And I know I sound really depressed and really grim, but actually I'm not, in a way, because I feel quite empowered by the fact that I'm able to talk about these things quite openly. And the whole point of this discussion is to put out in the open and say, look, we should talk about this a bit more, because we, as a society, we have been told not to talk about midlife crisis, or not to talk about it, not to take it seriously, because everything around it is completely frivolous. It is the guy who, you know, buys a Ferrari, a Lamborghini, Harley Davidson, and gets off with the secretary. It is Reginald Perrin, but it's a very real thing. And just to go back to Zoe Williams' article, she spoke to a guy called Mark Jackson, who's a professor of medical humanities at the University of Exeter, and he said, he feels that there should perhaps be, this is a quote from him in Zoe Williams' article, a new medical speciality to cover the years between paediatrics and geriatrics to help people navigate their middle years. And I mean, you know, I think it's that much of an issue that we don't talk about these things. And I think a lot of people get into this period of life where they do suddenly become very reflective of where they are and think, as you said, my youth is gone, the time of my youth is gone, and I am now in this completely different stage in my life, and I don't feel any different. I'm not mentally indifferent to what I was when I was in my 20s, when I'm early 30s maybe. Physically, I don't feel any different, but I'm in a completely different stage in my life. And it's just adjusting to that. And as I said, I know it sounds despairing and sad and grim and whatever, but it's not that really. It's more just trying to tune my mind to say, yeah, this is where you are, and life is still great. You've got loads of great things going on in your life. And I am appreciative of it all. But there are days when it's quite tough. There are moments when it's quite tough. I mean, just to give you a little example. So two summers ago, I went to Pride for the first time ever.
Okay.
It was a Saturday in the summer of 2017. One of those kind of quiet Saturdays where we didn't have anything to kind of do. So my wife said, should we go down to Pride? You know, the Pride march is going through London. So we went down, and it was a perfectly nice day. But it was just sort of moment that crystallised this all, where I'm watching all these young, fantastic, excitable people having a great time drinking on the street and dancing and what have you, and I'm there with my wife and daughter, and we watched it. And then we decided, there's like a, I don't know if you've ever been, but there's actually like a, they sort of cordon off a little park area for families or people who've got young kids who might get a bit overwhelmed,
yeah,
or a bit tired from watching the parade. And you can kind of go there, and it's lovely, and you sit there, and there's like a little park area, and there's an ice cream van, and there's a kids karaoke tent. And so we went over there, and my daughter was doing karaoke, and we were having an ice cream, and it was lovely, and honestly, it was really, really pleasant. But I did sit there thinking, over there, there's loads of young people going mad and having a great time and drinking cans, yeah, on the street, and I'm sitting in a park watching, yeah, kids do karaoke, and I thought, yeah, I'm not in my 20s anymore. It really kind of struck me as a kind of, you're in a different stage of life. And I think the other thing as well that, is when you get older as well, you see less of your friends as well. Your social life does change. And, you know, I've got a hardcore group of mates, and we're still in a WhatsApp group together. We still share messages, yeah, and have a laugh, but we don't see each other often. And,
yeah,
that part of your life goes as well. So, as I said, look, I know I sound kind of depressed and sad and all this thing. It's not that. It's just having to adjust and really come to terms with where you are in your life. And it can be hard. And some people, as I said, slip straight into it. I haven't. And perhaps it sounds like you haven't either. And, I actually think it's healthy then, if you are in that mindset, to talk about these things openly,
yeah,
and to recognise that a midlife crisis isn't this frivolous Reginald Perrin based thing. It's a real thing that a lot of people in everyday life have to cope with. And we should talk about it more and find the best ways to cope with it. And it's funny, when I talk about it openly, I feel absolutely fine with it. I don't mind saying I'm 38 years old. I don't feel embarrassed
by it.
I'm
always very open about my age, yeah, on social media. Pub quiz?
Pub quiz, should we head to the pub quiz? Yeah, it's,
yeah,
all got a bit deep and heavy, but now we're going to be a lot lighter and have a bit of fun. So, yeah, as ever, the pub quiz, and Lindsay's in charge. Do you want to tell
charge.
The listeners what we're doing today?
Anyone who doesn't read Empire, it's a film magazine, and every month they get a Hollywood star, and they do a little questionnaire with them, which they call How Much Is a Pint of Milk, because it's basically to try and find out how down-to-earth they are. But they're kind of just quite interesting questions, which I thought me and Sachin could answer.
Who's this with again, sorry?
This was Naomi Harris, one.
Okay.
And there's a few stars, with a couple of the questions weirdly tie up with some of the themes we've been talking about.
Let's do it.
So the first one is, when were you most starstruck?
Oh, that is interesting. Mm. That does tie in very well with what we're saying. God, you've caught me off guard there. I would say, and sorry, I'm going to bring this back to football and Liverpool specifically again. So, back in 2009, I think it's February 2009 specifically, I covered my first ever Liverpool match for The Guardian. They played away at Portsmouth, Fratton Park, the home of Portsmouth.
How long had you been a Liverpool fan for?
Oh, well, at that stage, 20 years.
Wow.
And I was sort of a couple of years into working for The Guardian. This was the first, I think this was the first time I covered Liverpool. I'm pretty sure it was. Might not have been, but I think it was. So first time I covered a team I've supported since I was a kid. And afterwards, the way it works is you get to talk to the managers afterwards. And the manager of Liverpool at the time was a guy called Rafa Benitez, who I adore. Brought me a lot of joy in my 20s, to bring it back to that. And so we spoke to him in a little room afterwards, post-match interview, get some quotes from him. And I was stood as close to Rafa as I am to you now, which is very close. And I did I was standing there feeling a bit giddy in the way that I don't
sitting
do
on
now.
His lap.
Yeah, in the way that I don't do now. You know, now I've been doing this job for sort of 12 years. If I meet a high profile manager, the manager of Liverpool indeed, who now is Jurgen Klopp, I'm quite chilled out about it. It's just part of the job. But back then, 2009, I did think, oh my God, it's Rafa, it's Rafa. So that might be the most starstruck. As I said, I've never met Noel Gallagher, never want to. Never met any famous musicians. Never met anyone particularly famous. So I would say when I met Rafa Benitez for the first time in 2009. What about you?
Okay. I'll give a Hollywood megastar and a closer to home star.
Here we go.
So my most memorable person that I've met in my career is probably Samuel L. Jackson.
Wow.
Yeah.
Big name.
I mean, come on. I'm a big Tarantino fan. Mm. Pulp Fiction is one of my favourite films ever.
My all-time favourite film.
Really?
I love Pulp Fiction.
Wow.
Love
Excellent.
It.
Excellent. Yeah. Oh, I kind of want to give you a high five right now, but my hands are comfy, so I'm not going to move them.
Fair enough.
Anyway. Yeah, Samuel Jackson was in the room, and I didn't want to bother him too much, but...
Was this a work-related thing?
Yeah. And as I said earlier, I know how to read a situation. I know when I can approach someone and when I can't. And he seemed quite approachable. And I went up to him and said, I can't remember exactly what I said, but it was something along the lines of, I'm a huge fan and I'm sorry. I don't think I called him Mr. Jackson, but if, like, for the sake of anecdote, let's just say, I'm sorry, Mr. Jackson, but can I just shake your hand? That's all I said to him. Can I please just shake your hand? And he kind of looked at me, went, all right, and shook my hand. And my head just exploded with pleasure. I was just, oh my God, I'm touching Samuel L. Jackson. And he's been so lovely. And then I remember for the rest of the day, whenever I went to the toilet, I would not wash the hand, but that shook his hand. I did not wash my hand all day.
How many days passed until you shook the Samuel L. Jackson hand?
Well, by the time, like, whenever I next had the shower, so that night or the morning after. But I remember kind of saying to everyone that I came across that day, this hand has shaken the hand of Samuel Jackson today. But that was, you know, that was really lovely. But then there was a time when I met someone who I really admired, and I went a bit funny and a bit stupid and a bit silly, and I'm really embarrassed whenever I think about it.
You're talking about me?
Huh?
You're talking about me?
Well, Sachin Lacrani, he writes for The Guardian. Oh my God. I mean,
the level of sarcasm in that answer was quite heartbreaking, to be honest.
No, it's David Mitchell.
Oh, really?
David Mitchell,
interesting.
Again, I asked if I could have my picture taken with him because I'm a big Peep Show fan.
Yeah.
I think he's incredibly funny and clever. And it was one of those awkward situations where as soon as I walked into the room and started chatting to him, I suddenly felt very nervous. And I think it was obvious I was nervous. And he could tell I was nervous, so my nervousness made him nervous. And he looked a little bit incredulous of why someone would ever be nervous, because he's quite, you know, he's not exactly a...
He's very low-key, very down-to-earth. I've never met him, but I certainly get that
sense. Seemed kind of embarrassed on my behalf, like, oh, I can tell this girl is excited to meet me, but why would anyone be excited to meet me? Kind of thing. So I just felt even more silly. So whenever I look at the picture that I have with him, I look very, like, bright face and kind of manic almost, and he looks a little bit kind of stupefied, like, where did this girl come from and what the hell was happening? So I always cringe a bit when I think about that, but that's probably the most kind of silly I've gone.
So you were more nervous about meeting David Mitchell than you were Samuel L. Jackson?
Yeah, I think it's because with Samuel Jackson, I approached him in a studio with other people around us.
Okay.
But with David Mitchell, I went into his dressing room and it was just us.
Right, what's next?
Next question. Oh, do you have any scars?
I do.
Tell me.
So I'm going to show you. So can you see, I'm holding my hand, I'm holding my left wrist in Lindsay's direction.
Here.
Yeah, it's quite dark in the pub. Can you see that line there?
Yeah, I can.
Yeah, so.
It looks like you tried to slit your wrist.
Not,
is it a midlife crisis?
No, I was nowhere near midlife when I did this. So to explain, so listeners, obviously this is a visual thing, but I've got a sort of line that goes down the bottom of my left wrist into my arm area. And the way I got that scar was I was playing relay races at my grandma's house with my cousins. I'm quite a big extended family. Years ago, I think I would have been about 9, maybe 10. So my grand's house, you know, big family visit to my grand's house. All my cousins were there. It was a sort of warm summer evening and we were playing relay races in her garden. So, you know, you stand at one end, you run to the other, you touch one side and then you run the other side. I can't remember the exact rules of it. But anyway, they have a patio door. And it was probably the only patio door in the world that was single glazed. Every other window in the world, double glazed by this stage. We're talking early 90s. But my gran and granddad had a single glazed patio glass door. So as I ran, yeah, exactly. So as I ran to touch the patio door on my leg of the relay race or whatever I was doing, my hand was meant to sort of just slap it gently to indicate I touched it as part of the rules of this relay race, but instead my hand went straight through the glass.
Shit.
I was taken to hospital by my dad and my uncle. And God, how many years? Well, 20 years on, because I was about 9 or 10. So yeah, no, 30 years on, bloody hell. Yeah, really am.
Old.
I really am old. I still have that scar, yeah. What about you?
I don't have any scars, but my fiance has a little scar near his eye from where a dog bit him in the face, from where he antagonized it, which
Jesus
every time he tells
Christ.
Me.
A dog bit him by the eye?
Yeah, like he's lucky.
How old was he?
Oh, he was a kid, like around the age you were when you did that. Because he's got like just a tiny little scar, just sort of right near his eye. And I said to him once, "Oh, how did you get that?" And he said, "Oh, yeah, like put my face right up against a dog when I was a kid, when I was being like a little twat when I was a kid, and it just went hum and just ate my face."
Was
basically.
It his own dog?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, yeah. At some point, it will be a guest in this podcast, and he can tell it far better than me. But
I mean,
yeah.
It goes without saying, he could have gone blind.
Yeah, yeah. But no, his eyes are still very
wow.
much there and intact.
Wow.
Thank goodness. I am a little bit. I've finished my third glass of wine. I'm a bit pissed now. Whereas Sachin's just looking very sober.
I'm alive.
Looking at me with judgment.
I'm actually shaking with life because I've got caffeine surging through my body.
Right, okay. We've only got one more left.
Yeah, let's do it.
Oh. The last one is what scares you.
What scares me?
Midlife crisis.
Getting old. I don't think anything particularly scared. I don't think anything's scared. I'm not scared of the dark. Scared of bad stuff happening to people I love.
If that you don't have any phobias?
No. Shut up. I've got a weird... not a phobia, but I've got a weird... don't know what the word is. It doesn't... Maybe it does scare me. Brace yourself, because this is going to get weird now, Lindsay. I hate apples. If I think about biting into an apple, I actually tense up and feel quite...
Really?
Yeah, it's the texture of apples. Even now, thinking about biting into an apple makes me feel quite tense. I've never eaten a whole apple in my life.
Thinking about biting into an apple makes my mouth water right now.
Oh,
like, ooh,
it's actually making me feel a bit sick.
The crunch and the juice and the skin.
Oh, God. Stop it. Stop it.
Or you get a pip in there.
Yeah. I don't think I'm scared of apples, but I hate them. I can't. I don't. I almost don't like being near them. My mum tried really hard when I was a kid to make me like apples. I couldn't do it. I'll eat pears. I like pears, but there's something about the texture of apples that really actually makes my skin crawl. What about you? Clearly not apples. You love them.
Well, I was thinking terrorism, dying alone, famine, world war. But you know, apples.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm easy
really
with all of
that,
those things. Yeah.
So.
If it's between apples or poverty or terrorism, in terms of what terrifies me most. Or makes me sad the most. It'd be apples, I think. Right.
Right.
On that weird note, I think we're done, Lindsay.
I think we are.
We are. We've drunk. You've had a lot more alcohol than me. I've had a lot more caffeine than you.
Makes a change.
We've talked a lot. I think it's been really fascinating discussions.
Yeah.
You've learned that I hate apples. I learned that your fiance nearly went blind through a dog. What weird lives we lead.
Yeah.
Right, so as ever, shall we end with the music? It's your phone this week. We're going to hit shuffle on Spotify on your phone. Pick a song that will be our lead out song for this podcast, our lead out music. Do you want to do it?
Yes.
Hit shuffle.
first, should we remind people to subscribe and rate us?
Yeah, well, I was going to do all of that.
Oh, okay. Well, shut the fuck up then. Last time I did this, I did shuffle my Euphoria playlist. Should I just do the same playlist?
Well, you came out with a brilliant track, which was Wuthering Heights, wasn't it, by Kate Bush?
Yeah.
So why don't we do the same playlist? Yeah, same playlist.
Really crap one now because I've got some stinkers as well as stonkers on here. But let's have a look at what comes up. Right, I've got the sound off.
Go for it.
You know what? It's chosen Wuthering Heights by Kate Bush again. So I'm going to press shuffle. I'm going to press shuffle again.
Have you only got one song on your phone?
No, it's got like 80 songs on it. This is a good one.
Okay, let's have a look. I know the band. In fact, I know the song as well. Yeah, I know the band. I saw them perform at Benicassim in 2006. Yeah. My favourite summer ever, 2006. And I'm pretty sure that performed that song. Is that their most famous song? Certainly
there's
an iconic song,
isn't
it?
There's one other song by them that I like more than this one.
Yeah. But that, yeah. Great band, great song, great choice. So, as Lindsay had just said, I should do, and I was always going to do, let's do it now. So, please, as ever, rate and review this podcast. I noticed, actually, we've gone up to 5 as our rating on iTunes. Yeah, we were at 4.5 for a long time, so somebody said something nice about us or given us some nice ratings. That's
we're
very
5
good.
Now.
We are 5 now, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so it's very kind of whoever's bumped us up. Aww. But yeah, please do rate
Thank
and review the podcast. And I believe it helps other people find this podcast, so it's very important.
Excellent.
And get in touch in general. We have our Twitter account. So I've just got somebody helping Lindsay with her scarf. Thank you
very
much.
My scarf was on the floor and someone was just telling me. I'm a very nice, kindly man.
Yeah. See, you're not
Maybe
invisible.
Maybe he'll give us 5 stars.
Yeah, and see, you're not invisible.
I'm not invisible.
So yeah, rate and review and get in touch via our Twitter account, which is at ITTOpod, and the email address, which is ittopod@gmail.com. Still haven't received an email yet, Lindsay.
I know. I was going to ask you, have we had a single email
yet? We haven't
had
an email. Even Malcolm has an email.
Malcolm, can you email us, please?
Yeah. So get in touch via Twitter or email, and please rate and review, and just keep listening. Lindsay, say goodbye.
We love you. Bye.
An underwater guy who controlled the sea. Got killed by 10 million pounds of sludge from New York and New Jersey.